This is In the American Tree, New Writings by Poets. I'm Lynn Hagenian, and with me tonight is my co-host, Kit Robinson, and a very special guest. Kit, why don't you introduce?
Well, it's my extreme pleasure to introduce tonight, which is actually this morning, Ted Berrigan, who has arrived from New York and is going to read for us. Ted, I'll read some recent poems to start to show off. This is a poem called Whitman in Black, and it's from a new book I just finished of 50 poems called Easter Monday. Whitman in Black. For my sins, I live in the city of New York. Whitman City, lived in Melville census. Urban inferno, where love can stay for only a minute, then has to go to get some work done. Here the detective and the small-time criminal are one, and though the case gets solved, the machine continues to run. Big town will wear you down, but it's only here you can turn around 360 degrees. And everything is clear from here at the center to every point along the circle of horizon. Here you can see for miles and miles and miles. Be born again daily, die nightly for a change of style. Here, clearly here, see with affection. Bleakly cultivate compassion. Whitman's walk unchanged after its fashion. And I'll read one that's maybe a couple of years older, but not so dissimilar from that. This poem, in its title, well, the title sort of contains my entire sense of what it's like to live now in this century, in this time, in the United States of America, or maybe anywhere else for that matter. It's called Buddha on the Bounty. The Bounty being the ship, His Majesty's ship, the Bounty, from Mutiny on the Bounty. Buddha on the Bounty. A little loving can solve a lot of things. She locates two spatial equivalents in the same time continuum. You are lovely. I am lame. Now it's me. If a man is in solitude, the world is translated, my world, and wings sprout from the shoulders of the slave. Yeah, I like the fiery butterfly puzzles of this pilgrimage toward clarities of great mud intelligence and feeling. The elephant is the wisest of all animals, the only one who remembers his former lives, and he remains motionless for long periods of time, meditating thereon. I'm not here now, and it is good absence. And I'll read this poem, which you requested me to read, Kit, called Here I Live. It's from my book Nothing for You. Which is published earlier this year by Angel Hair Books in Lenox, Massachusetts. I wrote this poem, I think I wrote it in maybe 1969. I wrote it by a method, in fact. I write everything by a method, but I wrote this by a method in quotes. It's called Here I Live. So, sleeping and waking, every day, up, I live here. I, the great mumbling 1, 2, 3, 4, laid out voices, living and dead, hovering between heart and comfort. Up now, taking chances with silence, more and more waiting for day, light over the house. He is counting, 1, 2, 3, 4. When we rise, the jungle moves, what that means. Grenades come closer, white lightning clears the range in the morning. Paper hangs on nothing, nerve that makes some human cry float like sunlight. But every night I sleep, going to dawn like light. Here I live, my heart, my family assemble. Three counts, sun clear, time my war, God did it start. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. counting thing is like, I mean, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to do in a poem, except that you're actually counting. I mean, when you say one, two, and three, you know, I mean, the syllables have a certain duration and a certain rhythm. And, I mean, you've done that in other work, too, right? I mean, you got that thing where you count, right, with the numbers. So what is that?
What other word?
Well, actually, in the sonnets, there's a point where you say one, two, three, four, right? And it's...
I don't remember, but I'm sure I have done it before, right, because it's something I do. In fact.
Right.
Well, in this poem, the person talking is named I, and the that's really all the name you're given for the person talking, and there was a need to give some definition to that character, and the clearest definition I could think to give in the state, the psychophysiological state that that person was in when saying these things, was to show that that person was made up of constituted a nexus of parts named 1, 2, 3, and 4, or I mean, it could have been named I, you, he, and it.
Yeah,
you know, it's that.
Right.
It's the pronouns.
Right.
Broken down to a more.
So there's like planes. So that's like an axis and a y axis.
They're planes, yeah.
And then a time, and then there's a time. You know, there's
you
a
just
time.
Mentioned a secret actually of all my entire poetry, which is it has to do with planes of reality, of perception, not of reality because that sounds theoretical, but just with planes of being. I mean. Not in a theoretical sense, but in the sense of trying to get it accurate. You know, I am talking to you, but he is thinking about it while I am talking to you. You know,
and they said something about this too, right? And other people's voices come into your work.
You know, they are over there though, and I is here.
Yeah,
and he is a little bit over there, but is near.
So there's an incredible sense of location, like
when
you say 360 degrees, you know, you get a center.
Too. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And you get a circumference and a point of
something feminine when you can, if you can actually get 360 degrees, which I didn't realize, I suppose, until a few months ago, that you could have planes and still have a circle, which is a really nice idea.
Right.
All that sounds so abstract. When it's not abstract when I'm doing it, it's simply trying to have something exist without describing it.
Right.
To name its parts rather than to describe it. I don't. Description is slow and I can't keep up the pace of my metabolism when I am using description usually. So, but I can do it while simply naming things. Now, I don't use images very much, but I will name an image. I mean, I will say a tree. I don't try to make a picture of a tree for you. I assume that.
What about in your novel, In Clear the Range?
Yeah, what about it? I mean, that's another story entirely. I mean, that's a poet's novel, you know. I wrote it as this poet that was writing it, and it's a genre work, a genre which I was thoroughly familiar with, a Western novel, you know, and I used the genre then to make everything be very slow and to make this setting in which there was a hero and a villain, almost like in Commedia dell'arte, and then there was a girl. And then there were various other characters, including a horse and a mule, but I mean the main thing that was going on was that the villain and the hero were constantly having these Western confrontations, in which they didn't finally pull out their guns and shoot each other, and they were very similar, so, except that the villain was obviously villainous and the hero was obviously the hero, and. Anytime one of them did anything, like go into a restaurant or a bar, then the other one was the waiter or the bartender, and they had these confrontations every minute. Mm-hmm. And I think I thought I was making something similar to Camus' book, The Stranger, in which the guy, in which Marcel, the hero, walks around and becomes totally bemused by the sun sort of smashing on his brain every minute, and he ends up. Seems that he killed somebody.
Yeah.
He doesn't quite remember, or he does remember, but he doesn't know why he did it or anything particular, but he did it for a very good reason. It was too hot.
Yeah. So how does logic or narrative get you to, to that, like too hot, like you got to move, right, in this poem.
Wait a minute, you have to explain this question.
Oh, yeah.
What is that?
Well, okay, so you got a narrative in Clear the Range, right?
Yeah.
And the narrative is given by the genre. It's given, right.
But in poems, it's not.
Right.
Maybe it is, but in a different way.
It seems like in the poem, Here I Live, what does that is not narrative, but it is some kind of sense of logic, And so, 1, 2, 3, that follows,
Does it?
No, it doesn't, but it
practically does. Sure.
Well, okay, the first word.
All right, well, my sense, I suppose, quite often when I'm writing poems is that I'm going to tell a story. So in that sense, it is kind of narrative. It's narrative in the sense that it is telling, but I don't really want to tell. I don't want to be this teller. I don't mind being a teller of tales, which you make a story. So I'm making something, but I'm also telling. So I start out with a story, and I have the structure of a story,
right.
But I'm not very interested in the story, but rather in the feelings involved. And so I take out as much of the plot as possible. I just leave out as much of the plot as possible. I don't even consider most of the plot. I put in the complete.
You've got a
structure, scaffolding. Sure, the architecture of a story, and then leave out and put in the things that are necessary. In that sense, it's a kind of impressionism, but it's not an impressionism of making pictures of impressions, but of using words to get details, because I'm mostly involved with rhythm, tempo, pace, and various color and so on, in order to get the feeling that's being involved. And yet, pure feeling is not enough. You need to have some sense of what kind of person is talking in this poem, and I do try to give you that. Not the person that I think I might be all the time, but the person that is talking in that poem. And there you have it. I give you a story, but I don't want to.
But the poem is there.
I'm interested in telling you.
Yeah,
the poem is to exist very much like a tree.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
We're going to continue on now with our guest, Ted Berrigan. This is In the American Tree, New Writing by Poets. Ted, you have a sequence of things?
Yeah, I'll read three poems from a book which I just completed, I completed it 3 or 4 months ago. It's called Easter Monday, and it's 50 poems. And most of them are close to the same size, which is about one of my favorite size, which is about 14 lines. And when they are sonnets, in fact, but they don't really work at that too much. Not all of them are. Some are longer. None are shorter, but some are quite long, quite a bit longer, because they just got longer. Sometimes when they did, I just let them be longer. But these 50 poems are, 50 was an arbitrary number I decided upon ahead of time, based on the theory that if you do 2 or 3 works that are fairly similar and then you like them, even if you just do one, if you do one work and you like it and you can do another one similar to it, there's no particular reason to do the next one, the second one, or there's no particular reason not to do it. But if you feel that you have a number of them there, you can set yourself this arbitrary number and just decide, well, I'll do 50 of these. And then you're sort of clear as to what you're going to be doing for a while. You know? And I got that idea from this painter, a friend of mine. So I did the 50 of these, and it took me a lot longer than I thought it would. But I set out that I would do 50. And it's called Easter Monday because it's really about second life. The beginning about the age of 40, and since it is personal, it's the second half of one's life. It's about being young, a young older person, I was involved in second marriage, second family, but even if I hadn't been, it still could have been the same thing. And consequently, it is like Easter Monday. Easter Sunday, Easter Friday you die, and Easter Sunday you rise again from the dead, and that's really glorious and wonderful. But then Easter Monday you have to get this job and support yourself for the rest of your life. And the poems—the poems are all written in the 2 or 3 or 4 years from the time I was 38 until last year when I was 42. So they're not all about one's whole second life, but rather about being aware of coming into that. When I say they're about something, I strictly mean about. I mean, they are about that. I don't know what each poem is about particularly. I could study them and tell you what each one is about, but that's not what I'm going to do. Each poem is a very separate poem. They're not like my work, The Sonnets, where although every poem was meant to stand on its own, they were sequential and serial in a certain way. But there are some carryovers, some repetition of things, but it's really like 50 separate works which were done knowing I was going to do 50, and therefore they relate that way. And I knew what the themes were, though I didn't work at them too hard. I just knew what they were. This is the first three. The first one is called Chicago Morning. It's dedicated to the painter Philip Guston, simply because I was looking at a painting of his while I was writing, because it was hanging on the wall of the typewriter. And so I actually used some things in his painting to refer to when I couldn't think of anything else to say. Chicago Morning. Under a red face, black velvet shyness, milking an emaciated gaffer, God lies down here. Rattling of a shot engine heard from the first row. The President of the United States and the Director of the FBI stand over a dead mule. Yes, it is nice to hear the fountain with the green trees around it, as well as people who need me. Quote, lovers of speech, unquote. It's a nice thought, and typical of a rat. And it is far more elaborate than expected. And the thing is, we don't need that much money. Sunday morning, blues, blacks, red and yellow wander in the soup, gray in the window's frames, the angular explosion in the hips. A huge camel rests in a massive hand, casts clouds a smoggish white out and up over the loop, while two factories, bricks, and a fortress of an oven, kiln, rise, barely visible, inside a gray metallic gust. The fop's tunic. She gets down off of the table, breaking a few more plates. Natives paint their insides crystal white here, rooms. Outside is more bricks, off-white, Europe at night. The second one is called Newtown. Newtown is a section of Chicago. Sunday morning, here we live, jostling and tricky. Blues, blacks, reds, and yellows all are gray in each window. The urbanites have muscles in their butts and backs, shy, rough, compassionate, and good-natured. They have sex in their pockets. To women in love with my flesh, I speak. All the Irish major statements, and half the best, low slung stone. Upstairs is sleep, downstairs is heat. She seems exceedingly thin and transparent. Two suspicious characters in my head. They park and then start the same way you get out of bed. The pansy is grouchy. The ideal family awaits distribution on the planet. Another sensation tugged at his heart, which he could not yet identify. Half Romanian deathbed diamond, wildly singing in the mountains with cancer of the spine. The end. This is the third one. And these are the first three, actually, that were written. And it was after writing these three that I then decided I would go on and write 47 more. The end. Which is why I call this the end, actually, because I, you know, why not get the end out of the way right away? Despair farms a curse, slackness in the sleep of animals with mangled limbs, dogs, frogs, game elephants, while there's your new life blasted with milk. It's the last day of summer. It's the first day of fall. Soot sits on Chicago like a fat head's hat. The quick abounds. Turn to the left. Turn to the right. On Bear's head, two malted milk balls. Quote, through not taking himself quietly enough, he strained his insides, unquote. He encourages criticism, but he never forgives it. You who are the class in the sky, receive him into where you dwell. May he rest long and well. God help him, he invented us, that is, a future, open, living beneath his spell. One goes not where one came from. One sitting says, I stand corrected. Let me read one more of those. Since my voice started to click in about the middle of the third one. This is the one that came later. It's maybe about the 30th one. And it's this is a made work, and it was made from a master list in a psychology textbook. And the title of it is From a List of Delusions of the Insane, What They Are Afraid Of. And this is a fairly classical sonnet of 14 lines, which works, in fact, in 3/4 and a 2. From a List of Delusions of the Insane, What They Are Afraid Of. That they are starving, that their blood is turned to water, that they give off a bad smell, being poor, that they are in hell, that they are the tools of another power, that they have stolen something, that they have committed an unpardonable sin, being unfit to live, that evil chemicals have entered the air, being ill with a mysterious disease, that they will not recover, that their children are burning.
What a list.
Yeah, well, their children are burning, and we are those children, and they are those children.
Right.
And they are not insane.
Yeah.
All those things are very true. I mean, evil chemicals are in the air, and we are...
they are poor.
We are in the control of another power, you know. Yeah. We have stolen something, namely those lines. I mean, one has to be as witty as one can in the face of the Holocaust.
You mentioned earlier on one of the earlier poems in the first part of the show about montage.
No, kid, man, I don't use such highfalutin words.
Does collage or montage technique come into your work at all, consciously? I mean, is that one of
the I mean, I use any possible way of making words, but and I don't remember it too much now, you know, but. I mean, I just do what it is I do, but when I was early on doing things and learning how to make poems my way, I was very heavily influenced by painting, by music as well, but to talk just about one thing, by the painter's art, and on one level I was tremendously influenced by Cubism, because basically because I see flat anyway, and I am interested in planes. And when I first saw Cubist paintings, it seemed to me that they made great sense to me. I mean, I'm sure that I was misunderstanding in many ways, but they made great sense to me. And then I sort of, I mean, I followed that immediately into use of collage and the idea of making assemblages and all sorts of things like that. And sure, I'll use any material from anywhere, and I like to do it. I'll make works like that one that I just read, which is made entirely of material, selected material, from one particular source. Sometimes I collect material. I mean, I write it down in little notebooks and so on. When I'm reading, I like to read. I read all the time, all sorts of things. And if something strikes me by how it sounds, if it sounds like something that I actually might have thought if I were thinking that way, in those very words, I might copy it in a notebook, and then I'll use it later in some poem, because sometimes when I'm making poems, I just thumb through my notebooks and put in anything that seems appropriate to what I've already put in. And I don't credit the sources, you know, why should I? I mean, those that recognize them will see where it comes from and get some added sensual brain cell pleasure from noticing it, and those that don't, it doesn't matter anyway. I mean, I don't mind if I don't make up all my own words. Yeah, I use all sorts of techniques like that. I read in a book once that someone said, it would be nice if it were Whitehead that said it, but it was someone like that, and it said, no great art without great theories. And I believed it, and so I have great theories. And I can't entirely remember what they are, but I remember when I conceived them initially, and I still go by them, even though I don't remember the theories too well. I have millions of theories that have to do with rules for writing and ways to write and ways to make things and so on. For example, that poem that I read called Cranston Near the City Line was part of the method that I used, the rules I used governing it when I wrote it. It had to do with some of the ideas that Kenneth Koch used teaching poetry writing to old people in nursing homes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And it was something like 6 ideas that he used. And I tried to see somehow if I could use all 6 in one poem without having it be a poem by an old person. I don't want to go to a nursing home and do it. Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't have to worry about writing poems by Kenneth Cook because he's a Harvard educated guy. Kenneth is a wonderful poet, but as Ron Padgett said, poets like Kenneth Cook and John Ashbery, they're too clean, actually. Those guys are very clean. I mean, that's not a criticism, it's just a joke.
So, let's see, I was going to ask you about rhymes. I noticed a few rhymes in your poems, but I sort of had the sense that there were even rhymes there which I didn't hear because there were delayed rhymes. You know, like in the first one that you read, you're talking about hearing other people's voices, and then you say the soup. And my take on that was the soup was like alphabet soup or something, you know. And
take is included in the word, yeah. I'm not as imaginative as that.
Well,
but once I think of the word, then I see that that can
work.
Well,
that's how I heard it, you know.
That's actually the way everything looked out the window in Chicago in the morning.
The soup, right.
Yeah.
The air, right.
Yeah.
And then you get to the loop, which, you know, like it was a really long delayed.
I had never noticed that four lines later.
I'm
glad you pointed that
out. But it was a stretch. And the same thing happened from the title to the last line because the title was Chicago. And the last line is Europe at night, you know, which is almost like a negative or something, you know. So, like, when you're writing, do you have the sense that you're holding something in your short-term memory that you're gonna turn around, but you don't want to do it yet?
Yeah, that's a fairly accurate way to put it. I think, yeah, I love rhyme, and I love even just mental rhyme. You know? I mean, every kind of rhyme, I love it actually. One of my most favorite poems is Annabelle Lee, for example. I like words from the Solitary Reaper. I like rhyme a lot, and I feel that if you are in the way that one actually says one's words now, that there's room everywhere for rhyme. You know, that is, when you think of a poem like Annabelle Lee, written in measure, I mean, in a fairly strict measure, and you think of it as how you learned it in school, you know, in the 6th grade or 7th grade or whatever, and it says, and there are lines which say, I was a child and she was a child in our kingdom by the sea, but we loved with a love that was more than love, me and my Annabelle Lee. And that sounds, that's that music, you know. But in fact, if you think of how you would say it if you were saying that, you know, if you were telling somebody that, and it was just quite a significant story, and you would say, I was a child and she was a child in our kingdom by the sea, but we loved with a love that was more than love, me and my Annabelle Lee.
Like the difficulty of actually
saying it's the movement of stress. You know, when you put the stress of the emotion on it rather than the stress of the measure, then you have two beats, two measures going at once, two kinds of melody, actually. And that's actually what I do. That's my avant-garde. That's where I'm avant-garde. I believe that you can have two melodies simultaneously. And I don't measure. I mean, I don't use.
You get a modulation that you can feel.
Yeah, Carcou had said to me once that I love the old-fashioned music, and you could see it in my works. And he meant it as a compliment. I mean, he meant, well, because what I do is take it out of the heart of the matter and put it all on the surface, and I don't like putting the skeleton on the outside in some way.
It's a very strict formalism in a way.
It's like if you can consider that De Kooning and Vermeer are doing the same thing, then you have a sense of what it is I would like to.
Right, landscape and the body.
But just that formalism, I mean, that kind of formalism.
Right.
I'm strictly a formalist. I mean, if I think of a phrase and I have a feeling to write, and then if I don't have a formal idea, I couldn't even write. I couldn't even go on. You know? As soon as I have a feeling, and perhaps a sense of the melody, a phrase in the melody, and a few words, then I'm reaching for some kind of formal idea, and then I work with that and against it.
Right.
I'll go directly with the formal idea, or I'll start to go with it and then try to and introduce countermeasures to keep myself from achieving it until such time as I can achieve it.
Yes. Yeah.
So what would you like? I mean, can I offer you something else?
How much? We've got plenty of time. We've got 9 minutes.
All right. So, do I have any good words? I'm not sure. Right. Let me see.
One from quite early, and then a and one fairly recent, and see if they're similar. Because I think they are totally similar. Here's a poem I wrote in 1962, and it's called Personal Poem Number 9.
It's 8:54 a.m. in Brooklyn, it's the 26th of July, and it's probably 8:54 in Manhattan, but I'm in Brooklyn. I'm eating English muffins and drinking Pepsi, and I'm thinking of how Brooklyn is New York City, too. How odd. I usually think of it as something all its own, like Bell's Falls, like Little Chute, like Wee John Boo. I never thought on the Williamsburg Bridge I'd come so much to Brooklyn just to see lawyers and cops who don't even carry guns taking my wife away and bringing her back. No, and I never thought Dick would be back at Goode's, beard shaved off, long hair cut, and Carol reading his books when we were playing cribbage and watching the sun come up over the Navy Yard across the river. I think I was thinking, when I was ahead, I'd be somewhere like Perry Street, erudite, dazzling, slim, and badly loved, contemplating my new book of poetry to be printed in simple type, on old brown paper, feminine, marvelous, and tough. That was written in 1962. Here's something I wrote in, maybe about 5 years ago, 1973. This one, maybe this one. This is perhaps a little more wordy, but maybe there's some similarity. This is called Crystal. Be awake, mornings. See light spread across the lawn, snow, as the sky refuses to be any color today. I like this boat ride I'm being taken for, although it never leaves the shore, this boat. Its fires burn like a pair of lovely legs. It's a garage that grew up. Sometimes I can't talk, my mouth too full of words, but I have hands and other parts to talk lots. Light the fire, babble for you. I dream a green undersea man has been assigned to me to keep me company, to smirk at me when I am being foolish, a not unpleasant dream. My secret doors open as the mail arrives. Fresh air pours in around before they close again. The winds are rushing up off of the ocean, up Little Plains Road. Catch the wind in my head, a quiet song, and everything belongs to me because I am poor. Waiting in sexy silence, someone turns over in bed, and waiting is just a way of being with. Now a tiny fire flares out front the fireplace. Chesterfield King lights up. Wood is crackling. Inside, elephants rush and roar. Refrigerator's gentle drone. Imagined footsteps moving towards my door. Sounds in dreams in bed. You are all there is inside my head.
I hear that one is more feminine and more tough.
Yeah, it is more feminine. I was really, in 1962, when I was in a certain state, I was 28, and I was quite butch, actually. I was quite aggressive about everything. I mean, now I'm more campy, but gotta erase that part of the tape. By 10 years later, I was more able to be I was able to be mellower about my furious and more expressive perhaps of my loves, kind of, you know, and I wasn't really having so much to hack my way through the undergrowth kind of daily reality. I realized that nobody really cared what I did, so it was all right to do it well.
Part of the liberation of the second half of the life.
Right. I had been liberated as a woman, right?
Right.
I had suffered the pleasures of woman's liberation for myself, right? Now I have to suffer the pleasures of women, right? So, I mean, is there anything else that we should do?
We've got about 3 minutes.
I should read another word.
Another word.
Right.
Yeah.
I should read the work that will be the summation of my entire life and career. Do I have any works like that? Yeah, maybe I do.
The Once and Future poem.
This is a regression to an earlier kind of thing. It's called 3 pages. It's for Jack Collum. 10 things I do every day. Play poker, drink beer, smoke pot, jack off, curse. By the waters of Manhattan, flower. Positive and negative. Go home, read, lunch, poems, hunker down, changes. Life goes by quite merrily. Blue, no help wanted. Hunting for the whale. And if the weather plays me fair, I'm happy every day. The white that drives clear, the heart attack, the Congressional Medal of Honor, a house in the country, not enough.
And on that note?
Yeah, I'll close with a very short poem, actually. It's called Remembered Poem. It is important to keep old hat in secret closet.
Thanks, Ted, very much for coming in. It's been a treat having you here.
Thank you.
Tune in next week at the same time.